Good morning, you're listening to Upfront. I'm Salima Hamrani. This Sunday, Mexico will have its biggest election in history. Not only will Mexican voters elect a new president, but there are also 3,408 open offices across the country, from small local positions to large national ones. And at the national level, the political moment in Mexico might be shifting away from the ruling party, the PRI, for two big reasons. One is, of course, us, Trump, the US, and the effect that we've had on our southern neighbor. But the bigger concern is security. Because of former President Calderón's war on drugs, Mexico now has one of the highest homicide rates in the world, with disappearances, rapes, and murders hitting their highest rates last year. That means that Mexican voters might be tired of the status quo and might be ready to elect a leftist president for the first time in history. Meanwhile, over 100 politicians have been murdered in the run-up to this year's election, and at least 40 were current candidates, making it also one of the deadliest elections on record. As Mexican Supreme Court Judge José Ramón Cosío Díaz said, the entire country will end on July 1st, and the entire country will be reborn on July 1st. Joining us to talk about the election is Laura Carlson. She is the political analyst and director of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy, and she is joining us from Mexico City. So welcome, Laura.
Thank you, Salima.
So Laura, can you talk to me about what's been happening in Mexico leading up to this election? And let's start with the issue of the homicide rate and the cartels. So what did former President Calderón try to do to control the cartels, and why did it backfire?
When Calderón took office after what many consider a fraudulent election, in 2006, that in fact Andrés Manuel López Obrador, by most evidence, won. He came in as a weak president. One of the first actions that he took was to launch the war on drugs. This is the same war on drugs type of model in the United States, except here he launched the army, the armed forces, into communities to attack drug cartels. However, to attack them in a very selective way. And when this model that's imported from the United States and has been supported by the United States through the aid package called the Merida Initiative, when it was instituted in Mexico, it immediately increased violence. So why does that happen? Essentially, why it happens is that a drug cartel that controls a route is attacked, a kingpin is taken out, another cartel begins to try to take over that route. There's a turf war, or there's a war of succession within the same cartel. And meanwhile, the armed forces are being bought off in order to give an advantage to one cartel or another. It's been proven in many studies that anywhere this model has been applied, which is throughout Mexico, it immediately causes a huge increase in violence. Since the war on drugs was launched, there have been 200,000 people murdered in Mexico and over 36,000 disappeared. So the price to Mexico has been extreme, and people were very, very concerned about electing a new president that was willing to change that security model and focus more on public security and public safety than keeping prohibitive substances from arriving at the U.S. market.
Right. And very few of these murders are ever investigated or prosecuted. So there's no way for people to really mourn.
Yeah, and Salima, that's really a key point, because first of all, it leaves so many families without justice, in addition to their grief and their loss. And secondly, it sends a message to criminals. If there's impunity, and we're talking about impunity, which means cases that are not brought to justice, of over 95% in the country, that is to say, you add up the number of cases that people no longer bother to report because they don't believe in the capacity of the officials to resolve the case, the cases that are brought into report but then are not investigated, the cases that are investigated but are not tried properly, and then people who are not sentenced, you have the majority of the cases falling by the wayside in an almost completely dysfunctional justice system. And this sends a message to criminals that they can get away with murder, literally.
Okay, and so as you mentioned, we now have this other big problem, which includes the police and the government, and that's corruption. So talk to me about corruption in Mexico. How bad is it?
Corruption has traditionally been huge in Mexico. We had a one-party rule for 71 years with the Institutional Revolutionary Party, the PRI, and that was an institutionalized system of corruption. And in this case, one of the major points of López Obrador's campaign has been against corruption. And he sees this as not only a political issue, but also a moral issue. And he also sees it as an economic issue in the sense that the country would actually save millions and millions and millions of pesos that could be dedicated to other things if corruption were eliminated. We have corruption in the form of officials that are bought off by drug cartels in order to be able to carry out their businesses, and they participate actively with the cartels in their area. We have corruption of government officials who accept bribes for contracts. Mexico's been heavily involved in the Odebrecht scandal. Pemex, the nationalized oil company, has been famous for particularly corruption that channels public resources illegally into political campaigns. And that's the extent of it. This has a huge impact on the economy. It has a huge impact on politics, and it's having a huge impact on the elections as well. But most of all, it's had an impact in making people want a change.
So let's move into what's happening during this election. And quickly, who is the current president, Peña Nieto? Is he well received by Mexican voters?
No. President Enrique Peña Nieto is leaving office with one of the lowest popularity rates in history. And he is a big reason why the candidate that he chose for the pre-party is looking at about 19% of the vote. So the vote as it's laid out right now, according to the majority of polls, which have a fairly high degree of agreement on this, is about 19%, 22% to 50%. Mm. So you can see, yeah, the margin there that López Obrador has. So Peña Nieto is responsible for the lack of popularity of his candidate in large part. People just say, you guys had your chance. You've made a real mess here. We're not going to believe that somebody else from that party and with the same way of thinking is going to be any different. And actually, the conservative candidate, Ricardo Anaya of the National Action Party, is suffering from this same phenomenon. Because the National Action Party also ruled in Mexico for 12 years, and they also, you know, applied the same neoliberal economic model and the same security policy. It was, as we mentioned, Felipe Calderón who instituted the war on drugs. So they're paying the political cost of the situation that Mexico is currently facing. I think it's important to note, too, that the economy is also a major factor here. So we've got really security, corruption, and then the economy as well. We're looking at a situation where with the neoliberal model, probably one of the most orthodox in the hemisphere, Mexico has had one of the lowest growth rates of all of Latin America, just over 2%. Real wages have actually gone down. There is a strong feeling that the free trade agreement has not benefited the country, despite the narrative of Donald Trump that somehow Mexico won in NAFTA. So people were really ready for a change in economics, too. And López Obrador is not a self-professed socialist, but he's talking about measures that would redistribute wealth and especially about measures that would strip this very strong and very politically powerful elite of what he calls the privileges that they've enjoyed under the system over the past couple decades.
So let's talk a little bit more about Obrador, who goes by AMLO. Who is he? He was mayor of Mexico City at one point.
Yes, that's important because he has experience governing and he was successful at it. The people of Mexico City is one of the places where he has the highest level of support, which would indicate that they were satisfied with his term as mayor. He comes from a relatively humble background. The state of Tabasco was part of the PRI until the PRI split over issues of democratizing the country. And then he became part of the Party of the Democratic Revolution, which was the PRD, and then formed this party called the National Regeneration Movement, that has taken him to where he is now. He works on the campaign from a very grassroots level, you know, holds hundreds and hundreds of rallies throughout the state. That's his style, a kind of an everyman style. When he came into the stadium of over 100,000 yesterday for the campaign rally, it took him probably half an hour to reach the stage because he shook hands with so many people as he walked along the route, including, you know, signing books and just this real kind of man of the people image that's resonated He used to have a slogan of first the poor, and was very focused on that part of this population. In this campaign, he's in some way moved to the center by including more business members of the business community and trying to reassure them. And so he's got a coalition now that has a pretty wide range of views. Some people will be disgruntled, you know, some people will feel that it wasn't what they'd hoped for, but he's being fairly clear about what his project is, and he's saying that it does imply some pretty major changes for Mexico.
Tell me a little bit more about his opponent. The main opponent, I think, is Ricardo Anaya, who you mentioned. Does he have a chance in this election?
No, I mean, we mentioned the numbers. I mean, a 20 to 30% lead just can't be flipped in the next 2 days. So he virtually has no chance. And in fact, he's been dropping lately. He is a relatively young, 39-year-old member of the Conservative Party, socially conservative and politically and economically conservative, basically represents a continuation of the policies that we've seen up to now. And he made some enemies as he climbed through the ranks to win the candidacy of his party. And so he actually does not enjoy the full support of the party itself.
So Obrador has run twice before. So this is his third time running for president. What prevented him from winning previously?
He ran in 2006, and that was the election that I mentioned that the historical analysis indicates that he probably won. It was declared by the electoral authorities that Felipe Calderón won by half a percentage point. The López Obrador supporters refused to believe that outcome because it was also very strange the way it took place on election night. There were massive mobilizations of millions of people protesting and calling for a vote-by-vote recount, which the electoral authorities denied. In 2012, there was a fear campaign waged against him, as well as massive vote buying by the ruling institutional party that brought Peña Nieto to office. Much of this was in fact proved, but the electoral authorities decided not to take it into account. In the fear campaign, what was used a lot was to say, we don't know what this will bring. This is going to upset the ruling class. It's going to upset the economy. It's going to upset our international relations. It's going to upset the international financial community or the national financial community. In the end, they realized that it's just almost inevitable that López Obrador is going to win the elections and have been looking for ways to live with that more than to try to scare people away from voting for him. But the scare card worked to a larger degree in 2012. And the difference now is that people are so scared of the reality that we're living every day and ready for a change that even if there's an element of uncertainty, they're willing to accept it. And in reality, there's not much uncertainty. He is, as you mentioned, someone who ran one of the biggest governments within Mexico, short of being president, which is the mayor of Mexico City for 6 years. So people have a good idea that he knows what he's doing, and he's been pretty clear about his policies.
Okay, so Laura, I want to cut in here and play you part of an interview that I had done with Shannon Young, who is another reporter from Mexico. She is a reporter in the state of Oaxaca in the south. And we sat down to talk about some of the assassinations that have been taking place leading up to this election.
Well, the tabulations include also campaign workers, which there have been far more campaign workers than actual candidates. And there were also pre-candidates, people who were running in the primaries. At last count, it's 132 candidates, primary candidates, and campaign workers that have been killed since election season began in September of last year.
That's an incredible number of people.
Yeah, it is, really. And it's almost gotten to the point to where it's numbingly common. It's about once a week. And actually, in this final week of campaigning, just here in Oaxaca, in the state where I live, there were two major attacks. On Monday, five people were killed, including a candidate for a state legislative seat, in an ambush on their truck as they were traveling along a rural road. And that, I mean, really was a shoot-to-kill kind of incident. There was at least 80 bullets in that truck. So The candidate himself was killed along with four other campaign workers, and two other campaign workers survived, but with injuries. That was Monday. And on Tuesday, there was another incident that was also involving shooting at a politician who was traveling by truck along a rural road. Four people were wounded, including the candidate for a mayoral position in Pochutla. And he survived incredibly with four bullets to the stomach. That's just one week here in this state. And it's not just violence against candidates, but now we're seeing theft of electoral packages as blank ballots and ballot boxes are being distributed to polling stations throughout the state. You know, this would be in any other country. It's amazing to me how the capacity of humans to normalize extraordinary situations is. You know, you look back at you know, the cumulative number, 132 candidates and campaign workers killed in an election season. That's incredible. But yet, here we are looking at, you know, election results and debating candidates' positions and you know, punditing about the implications for this, that, and the other issue as if this were a normal democracy.
Right, and it's hard to even call it an election or a democracy when so many people have been murdered.
Yeah, it absolutely calls into question just really how legitimate the label of democracy is when people are kept off of the ballots by intimidation or by outright murder.
And so who's doing this? Who's targeting candidates?
Well, that would be an excellent question for investigators if investigations ever happen. And just due to the overwhelming volume of attacks against candidates, a lot of these cases aren't being properly investigated or don't stay in the public eye that much because, you know, last week's is replaced by this week's crime or, you know, Tuesday's overshadowed Monday's. Now, I think the most common perpetrator is organized crime. But, you know, there's so much of a gray area sometimes between official corruption and criminality. So it's really hard to say, lacking a proper investigation.
Then I guess the other question is kind of hard to answer as well. Why are they doing this? Why are they killing candidates and people helping the candidates run?
I think the simplest response is to keep people off of the ballot. You know, I mean, if you can't run if you're dead, you can't run if you're in the hospital. I think there's an open question as to actually what happens in those races, in the cases in which people were murdered or were heavily injured.
How are people still running for government given this fear that they could be killed?
It could be a mix. It could be a mix of reasons. You know, some people refuse to put themselves in a mental prison built out of fear to alter their behavior or convictions because they're scared something might happen. Other people may have a stake in the matter. For example, you may have, you know, the people who are left in the game are people who were anointed by those who are trying to keep others off of the ballot.
Okay, Laura, so you just heard that interview with Shannon Young, our reporter in southern Mexico, in Oaxaca, talking about these murders going on across Mexico. So a lot of these smaller seats could fall into the hands of, well, possibly the narcos. And if that happens, how will someone like Obrador root out corruption and killing if he's lost connection to political figures in towns, in small towns across the country?
That dynamic's been going on for a long time. Since the drug wars, the cartels have become more territorial. So instead of just like trafficking through Mexico or having production areas, they actually take over towns and communities like this and begin to be involved in human trafficking, in extortion, and in a lot of other crimes that really directly affect the citizenry as well as the violence itself. It's a very, very difficult question because the federal government has to figure out, you know, how to root out the corruption. They have to figure out how to control the cartels without precipitating a violent response on their part. What López Obrador is talking about is going to the root causes by looking at poverty, by providing education for youth, And particularly, there's a slogan that translates to something like scholarships instead of hitmen. And then my opinion is that legalization, particularly in the United States, which of course is the biggest market, is an important factor here too. Because if you take away this illegal market for drugs that the cartels are making their fortunes off of, they're immediately forced to downsize. They no longer have the same resources that they had to hire people, to buy off politicians, to purchase and smuggle weapons. And you begin to see a weakening that makes the whole problem easier to deal with.
Well, thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Laura Carlson. She is the political analyst and director of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy. And we also heard from Shannon Young, who is an independent journalist based in the southern state of Oaxaca in Mexico. And they were both talking to us about the Mexican election, which will take place this Sunday. And up next, in many states, pro-life pregnancy centers try to entice women who want to get an abortion to keep their babies. They often pretend to be real abortion centers, and they sometimes use vague language to confuse pregnant women. In North Carolina, one particular set of these centers came under investigation because they were also using federal money. Earn While You Learn, the program in question, had an explicitly Christian agenda, which makes its funding by the government incredibly problematic. Amy Littlefield, a journalist with Rewired.News, joins us to discuss, and that's all next after the news.